Good morning again, everyone. I will call to order this meeting of the Health and Human Services Conference Committee on House File 2128. As we've done previously, when the House had the gavel, we will call the roll just to find out who is here. Ms. Niedernhofer, if you would, please.
Liebling.
Present.
Schultz. Pinto.
Present.
Gomez.
Gomez present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher present.
Benson.
Present.
Abler. Utke.
Present.
Coran. Hoffman. I don't have a proper roll call list for this, so I'm not sure if the Senate has a quorum.
Okay, should we, maybe we, Senator Benson, are we have, I assume that some folks are just a bit late getting on.
Madam Chair, and Senator Abler had a family conflict, and I know that you talked to him about that. So people are late getting on. We're not taking action today. So I am comfortable going forward with the informational presentation and will send a reminder to my members that committee has started. So.
Yeah, no problem. And, you know, just for the public, we do repeat periodically that members are engaged in lots of different work at this time of year. And so we never assume that anybody's just, you know, sleeping in. I think nobody sleeps in around here. So, so that's just fine, Senator. We just kind of like to know, and I see that Chair Schultz is here as well. So anyway, let us get started then. So the agenda for today, and I hope we won't take the whole 3 hours because frankly, we have a lot of offline work to do and to try to get things move forward here. But today we wanted to take the opportunity to have Representative Samantha Vang here with us to talk about what is her House File 970. You will see if you look at the materials that Mr. McQuillan sent out to everyone, the way the bill was structured, it actually spreads across four different articles in our omnibus bill or in our side-by-sides, I should say. But I thought it would be helpful to us not, you know, we sometimes the way we're structured here makes us look at things in a very fragmented way and it makes it hard to understand what's really going on. So I asked Representative Vang to come and be with us today to explain her bill in a more holistic way. And then we can also ask questions and see where there's hopefully move towards some agreement. We're obviously not adopting anything today, but this is, as Senator Benson said, more informational. So we have Representative Vang is here, and then we have others on the call just for questions and discussion. And then after we get done with Representative Vang's bill, we're going to do something similar with Representative Ryer, who's going to talk with us about the dental provisions that she has worked on. So welcome, Representative Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. It's a pleasure to come today to talk about my provision relating to increasing the diversity of our mental health workforce in both geography and in cultural backgrounds. This provision is bipartisan in both the House and in the Senate, with Senator Upke carrying it on the Senate side, and has broad community support from mental health providers, students in the mental health field, advocates, community members, and nonpartisan organizations like NAMI. This provision provides comprehensive support to our mental health providers. As we all know, mental health support is greatly needed, especially in light of the pandemic. Yet at the same time, our workforce system has had a long-standing problem of being unable to keep up with demand. Communities impacted the most by this dire shortage of providers are communities in rural areas and communities of color. This provision is meant to address increasing providers across the state. Some of the key things in this provision are adding alcohol and drug counselors to the section governing the Health Professional Education Loan Forgiveness Program, and authorizes the Commissioner of Health to provide loan forgiveness for alcohol and drug counselors who agree to practice in designated rural areas. It also ensures there's diversity on licensing boards, strengthens continuing education requirements, convenes the boards to develop recommendations for professional licensing supervision, which is meant to increase access for providers to serve as supervisors and train in the next generation, aligning private health insurance to cover treatment provided by clinical trainees, expanding who can be a mental health practitioner by including a student who is completing an internship, allowing Children's Mental Health Grants to be used to provide supervision to clinical trainees from BIPOC communities, establishing a culturally informed and responsive mental health task force, and creating a work group to discuss alternative licensing. I want to emphasize that these provisions did not just come out of thin air, but as a result of many years of work and stakeholder involvement from across the state. This work goes back to 2013 when the legislature passed a bill requiring the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, MinSCU, to convene a task force to develop a comprehensive plan on increasing the number of qualified people across working at all levels of our mental health system, ensure appropriate coursework and training, and to create a more culturally diverse mental health workforce. Meetings were held across the state, surveys were conducted, and a large summit was held. Despite much of the work that has been put into creating this provision, I still continue to engage extensively with stakeholders, most significantly with the boards, the Board of Social Work, Psychology, Behavioral Health, and Marriage and Family. As a result, this language is the agreement we've reached with the board's input without taking away the work its licensees and the wide community stakeholders have put into. Members, this is a great provision. As this was going through the committee process, committee members and I have heard and seen the excitement this has generated among community members, advocates, and providers across the state. We have been presented with the opportunity to improve the mental health of Minnesotans. It's a matter of putting into law. I also have representatives from NAMI and Wilder who are here as a resource. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Well, thank you so much, Representative Vang. I really appreciate your work on this. And I was just thinking that even some years back, I know I was approached by, I think, some folks from the Somali community about this very concern that there were no culturally responsive mental health providers, and that there was a crying need for that, because if you don't understand someone's culture, how can you help them with their mental health issues? So I think this is a very helpful, and to have someone like you focusing on it and taking it through the process is really great. So members, I think one of the things, if you are not familiar with this provision, one of the things you might have gained from Representative Vang's explanation is that there are a lot of pieces to this. And I'm kind of giving you all a chance to raise your hands and hope we'll have some questions and discussion.
Madam Chair?
Senator Benson.
If we could start walking through language.
Sure, we could certainly do that. Okay, well, we are starting, the first section of this is Article 3 and Sections 37 to 39. And Article 3 is the Health Department section. So let's see. 37 to 39 is the portion that Representative Vang just talked about, which is the alcohol and drug counselors being added to the Health Professional Education Loan Forgiveness Program. And I should note too, and maybe Representative Vang can speak to this more, this is a cost provision. So this is not something we're going to be able to adopt today, but and that was not our intention, but there are different appropriations in different pieces of the bill, and some of them are scalable. So we hope to be able to, you know, loan forgiveness for professionals is something that we wrestle with a lot here, and it's kind of chronically underfunded. But it's very important. We know that for a lot of people, it's very hard to go through an expensive professional education and then be able to work somewhere where you might have a lower salary. So, you know, this is an important piece. And then I don't know how you want to do this. Senator Benson, should we have, maybe we should have nonpartisan staff walk us through, or would you like to ask Representative Vang about certain provisions? I'm not sure how you'd like to do it, because there are quite a few different provisions here.
Representative Vang indicated that there were some provisions that she and Senator Atkey had worked on. Are those in this section?
Representative Vang, do you know where those would be, or are they in here?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been carrying the House provision, the House file, and Senator Atkey, I don't know if you've been moving it on the Senate side, but he is carrying on the Senate side as well.
Okay. Let's just start with the House only provisions then, and when we get to agreement, when we get to places where there's agreement, we'll have Senator Atkey pipe in as well or comment. Starting with 37, this seems like a rather straightforward provision. So we're looking at R50. And so how much money do you add to the loan forgiveness program based on expanding it to alcohol and drug counselors?
Representative Vang?
Madam Chair, I think I can defer this to Representative from NAMI or to fiscal staff. We do have a fiscal note, but there are lots of components. It's a pretty large, lots of documents, I guess. And so it'd be hard for me to shift through.
Yeah, so let's see if Mr. Berg is prepared to do that. Mr. Berg?
Madam Chair and members, just referring to your spreadsheet, there are three sections of the spreadsheet that this appears in. There is the task force that is in the DHS section at line 420. The grants and administration of the grants at MDH is on line 1329. The total for that item is $3,812,000 a year, including both the grants and the administration of the grants. And then there's a smaller state government special revenue fund cost at four of the health licensing boards, the Behavioral Health and Therapy Board on line 1378, the Marriage and Family Practice Board on line 1404, the Psychology Board on line 1435, and the Social Work Board on line 1439. So there are six places in the bill in three sections, or six places in the spreadsheet in three sections that show costs for this.
And thank you, Mr. Berg. And for the grants at MDH, those would be ongoing, added to the base?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Benson, yes. It's all the costs. All the items in this bill in sections are ongoing costs, although the mental health provisions at MDH are a set number all the way. The cultural council has a startup cost and then has a lower cost, but yes is the answer to your question.
Senator Benson?
Thank you. And then for alcohol and drug counselors, we're adding them to a very long list: mental health professional, medical resident, public health nurse, physician assistant. So do they have training and educational expenses that are in line with the other professions that are eligible in this section?
Representative Vang, do you want to can you address that, or we could ask nonpartisan research too?
I believe so, but I can direct that.
If nonpartisan could give us some sense, is it a master? I should know this, but is it a BA? Is it a master's level?
I think Ms. Clarkquist might be able to weigh in here. Ms. Clarkquist?
Madam Chair and members, I'm going to need to look that up really quick if I can get back to you in just a second.
Thank you. And let's keep going because it also talks about designated rural areas or rural underserved areas. It looks like that definition is already in law. I just want to make sure I'm looking for the new language. Okay, can we just add them to an existing category of medical professionals? Okay, so if we don't add money, then this ends up being a diluting effect for everyone else. Increasing their reach is important. So when we get the education question answered, I think I'll have enough to have a conversation about this. The Senate did not hear this. I'm not sure where the language is.
And Senator, just to that point, you know, I've noticed over the years that members who want to add different new categories to the loan forgiveness program. And it is a problem often that we're diluting it. And I think what this speaks to is how expensive education is and the need we have to actually put more money into that fund. Because as I said before, we just create a system here where people want to do good socially responsive work and they're not there to get a high salary, and yet they can't afford it because of their high education costs. So this is perhaps a larger issue, but I am definitely supportive of what Representative Vang is trying to do here.
And I am too. Getting more people out into community, particularly after everything we've been through and seeing overdose deaths on the rise in the last year and the amount of recovery that Minnesotans are going to have to go through, I think. I'm not opposed to it. Again, the Senate didn't hear it. I don't know how much it costs. So when council gets that information, that would be helpful. Let's continue section 30.
Madam Chair?
Yeah.
Oh,
yes.
Sorry.
Ms. Clarkquist.
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, the licensing requirements for alcohol and drug counselors are that you have to have received a bachelor's degree plus 18 semester credits or 270 clock hours of academic coursework and 880 clock hours of supervised alcohol and drug counseling practicum.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's helpful. And then continuing, as persons enrolled in training, do we do that for others? I'm going to have to flip to R55. R53. And so we're just expanding. Okay, so we have medical residents, mental health professionals. So the creation of account, the health professional education loan forgiveness program, that list is smaller. Can you help me understand the differences? This is amended into medical residents and mental health professionals specializing in pediatric psychiatry. So I'm trying to make sure that we're keeping people on the same level of, first of all, the requirements for education, which is proxy for how much they would incur in student debt. So help me understand why we're amending it into this section.
Representative Vang, do you want to address that? Or I don't know if I see Ms. Abderholden is here from NAMI. Is that something she would be maybe better
the person to answer? I will defer to her first.
All right. Welcome, Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Sue Abderholden with NAMI Minnesota. We actually did work with the health department on this language to make sure we were putting it in the right place. And they felt that putting it with the mental health professionals in that section was the best place to do it.
Senator Benson?
Thank you. I'll have to look at this further and see what various pots of money we're accessing here, because we're adding a lot of language. And if you're a medical resident, you have a significantly different level of educational debt than someone who has a bachelor's with the district.
Let me just ask a question here. Maybe Ms. Clarkvist can answer this. So in this section, how does this work? Is there the amount of the loan forgiveness? Is it a flat amount, or is it based on a person's educational loans, or how exactly does it work, Ms. Clarkvist, if you can explain that?
Madam Chair and members, it's my understanding that it's based on the loans, the individual's loans. So it's not a flat amount, and it's for a time-limited period. I think they are eligible for loan forgiveness for a three-year period, except I think nurses might be for 2 years.
Okay. And so if somebody has really high loans, say they're a medical resident, they've got that level of debt, they're going to obviously be eligible for more than somebody who had a shorter period of time, such as these alcohol and drug counselors we're talking about, right? Ms. Clarkvist, I'm understanding that correctly?
Madam Chair, that's my understanding.
Okay, thank you.
And Madam Chair?
Yeah, Mr. Burke.
Yes, just further information on the question that Senator Benson asked about how much is for the loan forgiveness versus the continuing education grants. The rider split, it's not on the spreadsheet split this way, but the rider at the health department splits it into $3 million a year for the loan forgiveness program, citing the additional professions, and $500,000 a year for the cultural continuing education grant program. Those numbers are ongoing.
Okay, thank you. Senator Benson?
Madam Chair, I just want us to be aware. So I look at education levels as a proxy for debt, and as we dilute a pool, it then makes it harder for those people with higher debt loads to access resources, because there's only so much money available. And so I just want us to be cognizant, the more people we add to a list, if we don't add money, we're actually reducing resources available to people who are previously on the list. So as we make target-based decisions, I think that's an important consideration. And then moving on to adding general surgery residency, can you talk me through Article 40?
And Senator Benson, I don't think that's part of Representative Vang's bill. That is another provision. It was carried by Representative Bolden in the House, and I believe it actually came from the Department of Health. So
is this a governor's provision?
It was originally, but it was also carried by Representative Bolden in the House. So I think we could either skip that for now, or, I mean, obviously Representative Bolden isn't here. If you want to talk about that one, we could, but Representative Vang is not, that's not part of hers.
MDH is here. Can they address their request for adding general surgery?
Sure, we can see if somebody's prepared to do that. Is anyone from Department of Health ready to do that? Welcome.
Hi, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Lisa Timian. I'm Legislative Director at the Department of Health. So the general surgery was part of our policy proposals that we had this year. And really it came, my understanding is at the request of talking to leadership at the University of Minnesota Medical School, and that by adding general surgery, it aligns better with some of our other grant programs. Just ensures that general surgery is just another access point for underserved areas across the state.
Okay, thank you. That gives me some sense of where to look. And then the Homeless Youth Act, Chair Liebling, was that a policy request from the department as well? Maybe Ms. Timian knows.
I'm not sure exactly. Oh, I see. You're just kind of going through the language.
I'm just going through. Yeah, as long as I'm on the page, we're going to have to start making decisions.
Okay, well, let's see. That one, I'd have to. Sometimes these things are. Yes.
I can speak to that.
Ms. Timian, okay.
The homeless vital records for homeless youth, is this the question?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, that was not an agency policy proposal, but we did work with Representative Fisher on technical assistance on this to make sure it aligns and that there's no other issues and it addresses that.
Okay.
But it was not part of the department's plan.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Yes. And Senator, this is, I'm being reminded, this is a piece. Representative Fisher has a bill that, again, is spread across various places that was grew out of his experience with homeless youth being unable to get a birth certificate, and so there are a number of provisions around that.
Birth records continuing. Okay, so we've got a little more work to do on the records area. So, Madam Chair, what's next then for Representative Fang's?
All right. Decision? So I think we did. Let's see. We did. There was section 103 that was in the article 3, and let's see, did we cover that one?
We've gotten to 103. Yeah,
that was that's, well, we've been talking about it. That is the mental health cultural community continuing education grant program. So that we have mentioned it. Yeah. Mr. Berg was mentioning it. I don't know if there's more that you wanted to talk about in that.
Want to look at the language on
R126.
Yep. Requires, so it's a new grant program for social workers, marriage and family therapists, psychologists, professional clinical counselors who are members of a community of color. So do we have representatives from the social workers, therapists, psychologists, and clinical counselors? Or was there, because I haven't, I've heard concerns about this. I haven't heard there's agreement. And I thought Representative Banks said there was agreement. So I'd just like to hear if there's agreement, then it's just a matter of the Senate hasn't heard it. And we need to decide if it's moving forward.
Okay, well, let's let Representative Vang weigh in on that, and maybe Ms. Abderholden too could help if she needs it. Representative Vang?
Madam Chair, thank you, Senator Benson, for your question. This language was not something that the boards brought up that they had concerns with. This provision has been introduced since the beginning of session, and I have not heard any concerns from the boards regarding this specific language.
Okay, are the boards on today so they could?
Yes, I believe they are. Okay. I believe they are. Yes, although I don't know why the boards would have a problem with an additional grant program, but let's see.
Well, Madam Chair, if they have to do the work, they might. Expect somebody to do the work, all right, ask them if they can do the work.
All right. Well, Senator Benson, we have several people on, and if you have a question for one of them, please go ahead.
I just want to hear from, so this is continuing education for social workers, marriage, family therapists, psychologists, professional clinical counselors. And is this something that they can do? So if any of them would, oh, There's a hand raised.
Okay. Ms. Molenhaugh, welcome. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Jennifer Molenhoff. I'm the director of the Board of Marriage and Family Therapy, one of the four behavioral health boards noted throughout Representative Vang's bill. Specific to this particular provision, Representative Vang is correct. The boards had not noted specific questions or concerns about this provision. I will note just that overall, the board's fiscal note request related to the participation in this and three other work groups or task forces that are included in Representative Vang's bill were not addressed or were not fully funded. Again, I know we're talking policy here at this point, perhaps instead of money, but since I was going to speak, I thought I would make note of that. So this would be one of the four workforces or task forces for which there was a fiscal impact noted when we were asked to do the fiscal note, but we did not have policy concerns about this provision.
Okay. Thank you. And when we get to other items, let's continue, Representative Vang. Where are the other...
All right, the next section is, the next piece then would be in Article 4. And okay. So the bill is goes across sections 1 to 9 and 11 of the House. So this is the health-related licensing board's portion.
Okay, let's talk through these sections. I get it. Okay.
So just for anybody who's trying to follow along here, so these are, it looks like starting on R11 of section of Article 4.
Let's see, amending the Board of Psychology, at least two members outside the metropolitan area and two members of an unrepresented community of color. And so what are the current requirements? I'm gonna go find page R11. And it looks like this is a trend throughout the board appointments. Representative Vang, could you talk me through where this came from and what you hope to accomplish?
Representative Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this section looks to ensure there's diversity on the licensing boards. It makes sure that the that the board is doing reflects the needs and represents is reflective of the population of the state. So this is something that I've worked specifically with the boards to reach an agreement, and I can defer to Nami, Sue from Nami, who can also elaborate more, and also if the boards would like to jump into as well.
I just need to hear that the boards were in agreement. And so how many people are currently on the board? Are we adding people to the board, or is this to be inclusive within the limits that are currently on the board?
Representative Vang?
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, the latter that you mentioned is correct. It's not to add more members, but to currently be inclusive, and the board has spoken to me that currently they do meet these requirements right now too as well.
And Ms. Abderholden, do you want to jump in here for a second, and then I'll go to Mr. Sands?
Madam Chair, I just wanted you to know that we actually took the idea from the Board of Social Work, who had done this similar thing the year before and thought it was such a good idea that we thought that all the boards should do a similar thing.
Okay, and I'm going to go to Mr. Sands, who has his hand up, and he obviously has something to say here. Mr. Sands.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to confirm that we did work with Representative Vang on this, and that I would say, generally speaking, the boards are meeting these diversity requirements that are proposed already, and that we did work on the language with this.
All right, thank you. And Mr. Sands, you didn't introduce yourself here, and if you would just do that for anyone who doesn't know who you are.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Sam Sands. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Psychology. My apologies about that.
Okay, thank you so much.
And then before Senator. Mr. Sands hops off, if Mr. Sands, you could come back on video. The continuing education requirements, are we adding hours? So talk to me through about how the board feels about the continuing education hours.
And, Senator, before we hop there, are you, which sections now are you in particular?
Sorry, I'm just following down the list. So those would be section 2, continuing education.
Okay, and you are on page
R12.
R12. Okay, thank you. Mr. Sands.
Actually R13, but yeah.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, this provision would keep the continuing education hours for psychologists the same. So 40 hours is what we require over a 2-year period. And it would require 4 hours of DEI continuing education for our providers per every 2 years. And this is also language that we worked on with Representative Vang, and the board is supportive of this language.
Okay, and there are, this has been picked up from other places where it's been tried and found to be effective?
My understanding, thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Benson. My understanding is that from prior testimony that 9 other states have done something like this.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Senator Benson.
Let's continue then to Article 3, the Board of Marriage and Family Therapy. Again, I just need to hear from the boards that they were included. So I don't know if there's somebody from the Board of Marriage and Family Therapy, but it would be the same question.
Okay, Senator, I'm not sure, again, where you are exactly here. Could you just repeat? Yep,
section 3. Board of Marriage and
Family
Therapy.
Okay, section 3. Okay, you said Article 3, and I think that threw me. I wasn't sure. Okay. All right. Section 3. So we are on R15 of Article 4. So, yeah. All right. Ms. Mollenhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jennifer Mollenhoff, Executive Director of the Board of Marriage and Family Therapy. Similar to my colleague, yes, this the provisions do not increase the size of the Board of Marriage and Family Therapy. They just create a statutory requirement regarding appointees to the board. And we did work with Representative Vang on the 4-hour CE requirement. It does not increase the 40 hours over 2 years. It just creates a mandate that there is 4 hours of diversity, equity, and inclusion education by our licensees every 2 years.
And this is something that you can do. There's a curriculum you can pick up.
Ms. Bowen, huh?
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, I'm not completely certain how to answer that. I mean, our continuing education is provided by CE providers, private vendors. Okay. Yeah. So once they're aware of it, my assumption is there will be content offered. Okay. Yes.
Okay. Good. Thank you. And Chair Liebling, if I could, let's just keep moving through Article 5, Board of Behavioral Health. We're repeating the pattern. I just need to hear from the boards that these are things that they can execute and give them an opportunity to explain if there will be disruption. So we can.
Okay. Well, Senator, maybe, let's see, maybe we could speed this up a little bit by saying, let's see, we've got Section 5 is Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy. Right. And then Section 6 is, okay, that's still at Section 6.
Yes.
And so, okay, so is there somebody here from the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy? Yes. Ms.
Rick Sigal.
Rick Sigal, thank you. I'm sure you're used to that, people hesitating on your name. Anyway, so if you could just give us your reaction to the parts that affect your board, that would be great. Thank you.
Yes, similar to my colleagues, Madam Chair and Senator Benson, the same testimony, basically. The BBHT worked with Representative Vang on the language, and we are on board with the diversity, equity, inclusion language related to board member composition and continuing education requirements.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
And then Section 7, cultural responsiveness. Can you, that's proposed for the Board of Social Work. Increased knowledge, understanding, self-awareness, enabling social work. And so is this a mandate or what, Representative Vang, what does this do for the Board of Social Work?
Representative Vang?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Benson, this language occurs in the previous boards that mentioned as well. So it just continues the, defines the, what types of continuing education requirements for cultural, to be culturally competent in this work. So for the 4 hours. And I believe this is more specific to the Board of Social Work. I don't think this was my original language, but this was in consultation with the Board of Social Work.
And if the Board of Social Work could just speak to the language, right, or the ability to execute.
Yep. Ms. Zachar-Patrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Benson. My name is Kate Zachar-Pate, and I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Social Work. And I can also concur, like my colleagues, that we have worked with Representative Vang in crafting language, and in my case, specific to this particular provision, being able to craft how our statute is constructed so that it works well for us. So what you are seeing here is that we were able to craft a definition for the DEICE content so that it is clearly set out in our definitions. Hopefully that will communicate well for our licensees. And so we were able to do that. Similarly, our board certainly is accepted of the 4 CE hours in this specific content area. Again, it does not raise the amount of hours required every 2 years. For the Social Work Board, it is also 40 CE hours every 2 years. This names a very specific content area within that, so it doesn't increase those hours. And as Ms. Abderholden said, the Board of Social Work has had already very specific requirements for board member qualifications around diversity, and calls out both 5 representatives on our board who by statutory requirements must be either representatives of communities of color or underrepresented communities. So that is already in place for us. So you will not see that included for Board of Social Work. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you. Senator Benson.
Let's see, the clock hours required, that's not part of Representative Vang's report, is it? Let's continue, but as long as Representative Vang's here, let's continue working through.
Representative Vang, was that a question for Representative Vang?
Yes, I want to make sure that we're covering her provisions as long as she's here.
Madam Chair, yeah, that language, the new content clock hours is a part of my provision. It's not my original language, it's something that we amended later in the committee process to make sure that these requirements do not take effect until the next licensing process. So that, you know, licensees have time to fulfill these hours. So that's on a, to make sure that licensee have time to fulfill these hours when these can be contact.
Okay, thank you. What does that do?
I think I see, I don't know if Ms. Clarkquist wanted to or was able to jump in here.
Yeah.
Do you have a specific question, Senator?
Just trying to, what does this do? What do clock hours do?
Ms. Clarkquist?
So, Madam Chair and Senator Benson, it's my understanding that this Section 9 is structurally the way the Board of Social Work adds new requirements regarding continuing education. Their statutes are just structured a little differently from the other okay. licensing boards. So this is just how they like integrate new continuing ed requirements.
Okay. All right. Any other provisions that are Representative Vang?
And then we go to 11. So in the same article, so we're on R23.
Okay.
And this is the mental health professional licensing supervision.
Okay. What does this do?
Well, Representative Vang?
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, what this provision language does is convenes the board to develop recommendations for professional licensee supervision. This is meant to increase access for providers to serve as supervisors. So they can train in the next generation or the next students going into this kind of field.
And I think Ms. Abderholden may have something she wants to add here. Ms. Abderholden?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This did come out of the 2015 report. And what we heard is that particularly in rural Minnesota, it might be difficult to find someone, like if you're studying to be an LPCC, finding someone who's also an LPCC within that clinic who can be a supervisor. And so people were struggling to find people who could provide their supervision. And so the 2015 report said, you know, we should pull everyone together to figure out, is there a way that someone perhaps who's a clinical social worker and a supervisor could actually supervise the LPCC or another person trying to get supervision hours for their, to be a mental health professional. So this was particularly geared towards rural Minnesota, struggling to find supervisors.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Senator Benson?
And Representative Vang, was there agreement with the licensing boards that they could do this? And maybe Mr. Berg, how much does this cost?
Okay, well, let's start with Representative Vang while Mr. Berg looks for that.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, this specific language was not something that the boards brought up that they have concerns with. So there's agreement.
The boards are, okay. So if I could just hear from the boards that this is something they can do and then we can figure out how much it costs.
Well, you know what, Senator, I think we're going through this very fine tooth, which I appreciate, but maybe we could just speed this up and say that if the boards have any concern, because I know they're listening intently here, that they would just please raise their hand. Otherwise, we're going to, you know, maybe we can just speed it up a bit by doing that rather than specifically asking them each time. So Please do, members of the boards.
You know, Ms. Abdur Holden does get to speak.
Oh, I'm not stopping them from speaking. I'm just trying to raise, giving them an opportunity. I'm just trying to speed up the, you know, Ms. Abdur Holden gave some context. Okay, Ms. Mollenhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jennifer Mollenhoff with the Board of Marriage and Family Therapy to Senator Benson's question. Representative Vang is correct. We didn't have specific concern about participating in the supervision work group study. I will note that the language does address more than outstate supervision. It is broader language than that. It also addresses practicum and graduate supervision requirements. And I guess my shorthand way of summarizing the board's input on that provision was that we're happy to study it and look for ways to improve processes across all four of the behavioral health boards. Recognizing that to some of those points, the recommendations that may come out of the study is that certain types of changes aren't possible. And I think everybody was in agreement with that as well. And in terms of the cost, the board's fiscal note cost for this provision came in at right around $31,000 across all four boards, which at this point doesn't appear to be funded as part of the fiscal note request. And I was authorized to speak on behalf of all four boards to that point. So I don't think any of the other EDs need to speak to this provision.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you for that, Ms. Mollenhoff. And Mr. Berg, did you want to comment on the fiscal piece here?
Madam Chair, we got the $31,000 number. So I don't mean to cut Mr. Berg off, but I was just looking for a ballpark dollar.
Okay,
amount.
Well, if that isn't, if there's more to it or Mr. Berg feels he needs to weigh in, he will, I guess, let us know. Okay.
Continuing Vang, Representative Vang provision. Okay.
We are then on Article 6, Sections 3 to 4. And this is a really interesting provision that I must say, I initially, when I saw this, I was like, whoa, what is that? And then after I understood what she was trying to do here, I thought, this is a really great idea. So this is requiring a group policy that covers mental health services provided by a mental health professional to also cover services provided by a clinical trainee. And so sections 3 and 4, Representative Vang, did you want to speak to this before we go into more specifics on it?
Madam Chair, can you state the page for me?
Oh, yes, I can. Hold on one second here. All right, this would be R6.
Oh, yes. So, this just, because there's such a great lack of providers who are from bike box communities, and therefore, this language includes that the commissioner can make grants that the commissioner can make grants to provide supervision to clinical trainees from BIPOC communities. So it just continues on the theme of increasing access to supervision, and especially this one designate more so allowing it to make it affordable to BIPOC communities.
And I wonder if also if Ms. Abdur Holden, I think this might be something that you've also worked on. Am I correct on that?
Yes, Madam Chair. Is this, I'm wondering if I'm looking at the same page.
Okay, this is we're in Article 6, Section 3, and this is mental health services.
Mental health services. Thank you. So some health insurance plans actually pay for clinical trainees and some do not. And it makes it really hard for an organization to provide supervision to a clinical trainee if they're actually not going to get reimbursed for the services that they cover. So this is just making sure that in with Minnesota plans that they're covering clinical trainees like they would in other healthcare professions.
So Ms. Abderholden, this is kind of responsive to the fact that it's very hard to find training, correct? That we require all these hours and yet it's really hard to find a slot where someone will provide that training when it's essentially a cost to the trainer that's kind of what I remember. Is that correct?
Yes, and also that it's also difficult to do those hours if you're not getting paid. So if you're the clinical trainee providing the service and you're able to do a diagnostic assessment and do therapy and all of those kinds of things, but sometimes people have had to actually work for free in order to get those hours because they're not getting reimbursed by insurance.
So Ms. Abderholden, that kind of makes me think this goes back to that whole problem of lower income students who can't afford to work for free and then get locked out of opportunities because of that very thing. And we often hear this, you know, we read about this as like internships, you know, those wonderful unpaid internships that open doors. Well, that only works if you can afford the unpaid internship, right? So
exactly. And yeah. Again, I want to note that many plans do, but not all. So we're just trying to kind of level the playing field.
All right. Thank you. Are there questions or comments, other comments about that, Senator Benson?
Madam Chair, I'm looking, this does comport with MA, so we're already paying for this in MA in Minnesota Care.
Is that after Holden?
That is correct.
Okay, we do this for other clinical trainees outside the mental, other physical health professions, maybe. I'm not saying this correctly. So for other clinical trainees in non-mental health services, we already pay for this. The insurance companies already cover it. Okay.
That is, yes, Madam Chair, Senator Benson, that's my understanding as well.
And do you know if they do? Well, I'll look at 62A and do some research. Thank you. Any further Representative Bang provisions?
Okay, well, that covers Article 6. Now we have some that are in Article 12.
Okay, I'm going to go grab my other book. I'll be right back.
And so just for others who are on here, Article 12, it's Sections 2, 7 to 8, and 32. And this is the behavioral health article.
Section 2. There we go. Okay. Expands the definition of a medical health practitioner. Is this parallel to what we would do for medical practitioners?
Ms. Abderholden, do you want to address that?
So a mental health practitioner is kind of its own thing, honestly. And so there are certain requirements to be a mental health practitioner who are all supervised by a mental health professional. And so what we're doing is just making sure that when someone is doing their practicum as part of either their last year as an undergrad or their if they didn't study social work as an undergrad, they have to do a practicum their first year as a grad student. It makes sure, again, that they can get paid while doing that work and they are under supervision. So it's just for that limited period of time when they're doing the practicum.
So is this a new category? Because if they're not, you mentioned supervision. So the getting paid is different. So are they currently doing this work unsupervised, or why the transition?
Is that beholden?
Madam Chair, Senator Benson. So the transition, they will still be supervised, and everyone who's a mental health practitioner is supervised by a mental health professional. They're not able to, for example, do a diagnostic assessment by themselves or anything like that. Their scope of work is limited. But you often, you know, in order to get through these programs, you have to do the practicum, which is different than being a clinical trainee. And so we're just kind of expanding slightly the definition of a mental health practitioner, which also we have huge workforce shortages, even with mental health practitioners. So this will help. And it's largely in places like, you know, providing, you know, in day treatment or in residential treatment, things like that, where it's a little bit more of a team approach.
Madam Chair, Ms. Abderholden, parallels to, like, there are nursing practicums. So help me translate how this happens in other health professions.
Ms. Abderholden.
So it's difficult because, as you can see, the whole definition of mental health practitioner is pretty long. And there's various ways that people can be a mental health practitioner. So this is just really adding to the definition of mental health practitioner. It's not, we're not creating a whole new category. This category has been there. And I don't actually know off the top of my head, maybe exactly how this a practitioner works in other healthcare fields, because it's different than a clinical trainee. It's kind of like a different level of care, a different level of professional at this point.
Or not yet professional, working on, I'm sorry, yes. Working on becoming a professional. Okay, all right, let's keep going on more, Representative Bang.
Okay, so we've got, we are now on section 7 and 8. And
looks like there are section 7, there are some House provisions and Senate provisions that overlap. Senate does not, each bill has a clause. Could counsel walk me through what those differences are?
Yeah, and just Senator, I know Ms. Clarkfist is kind of pinch hitting today for other staff who are out. So I'm not sure, Ms. Clarkfist, that would might be something you wouldn't be, could you do that for us?
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, it's my understanding that House Section 7 and Senate Article 13, Section 1 amend the same section, but I think they're different.
Okay. Okay.
And the language from Representative Vang's bill expands the services that are eligible for children's mental health grant funding for people from cultural and ethnic minorities to include supervision of clinical trainees from communities of color. And then adds to the list of eligible services, mental health services based on traditional healing practices. And then the Senate section, I think, does something different.
Okay. And Representative Bang, could you tell me, did this come from NAMI as well?
Representative Bang.
Yes, my apologies early. What I spoke to early was this section. So it just, like I said before, speaks to the theme of increasing access to be a supervisor. So it allows children's mental health grants to be used to provide supervision to clinical trainees from BIPOC communities. That is, and Sue from NAMI can elaborate more too as well.
Ms. Abderholden?
Yes, Madam Chair. And so the section about looking at traditional healing practices actually builds on our work in the opioid bill, where we funded Native American healers as part of a way to help people recover from a substance use disorder. And we have seen it work well. There's the American Indian Family Center that uses Native American healers and elders, and they have found that to be really helpful. And so again, this doesn't, just gives the Department of Human Services the ability to provide some funding for these different types of services, just adding to the list.
And was that, Madam Chair, Ms. Abderholden, was that prohibited?
Ms. Abderholden?
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, it wasn't prohibited, but the last couple of years we've seen the department wanting to make sure that the language about how they can use the grants is clarified. So some of this language was added, I think, I'm thinking it was 4 or 5 years ago as well, just to clarify. So we just wanted to make sure that the department knew they could use it for this purpose.
So MDH requested clarification?
This is the Department of Human Services. It's the Department of Human Services. Yeah, we have the children's mental health grants and we have the adult mental health grants. And over the years, you know, there has been clarification for this. So DHS didn't ask for this to be clarified. We just wanted to make sure that they knew that they could use it for the purposes.
So there was no barrier before. Okay. All right. Continuing.
We've got section 8, culturally informed and culturally responsive mental health task force. Representative Vang, did you want to speak to this?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a pretty straightforward task force. It lists at looking at how can we improve recruitment from mental health providers from diverse racial and ethnic communities, how to improve cultural competency and cultural humility. So just, you know, continuing the theme of making sure that the providers are competent and reflective of the populations of the state.
Okay.
And the boards, the behavioral health boards, they could fill us in on if they can do this work and cost.
Okay, Ms. Mollenhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The boards had no concerns about participation in the culturally informed task force. This is one of the four groups for which there was a small fiscal note. The fiscal note noted a small cost of participation, and if I could make sure I provide you with the right number of what the participation in this one group, this group does, is the one of the four that extends through fiscal year 25. So it did have a longer fiscal impact. I can provide that number perhaps later in the hearing. Thank you.
It would be helpful, but this is something the board can do.
Yes, the boards did not object to participating in this work group or task force.
Okay. Thank you. Continuing with Representative Vang, provisions.
All right. So the last one is in Article 12, Section 32.
Okay.
And that is about a professional licensing pathways work group. I don't know if Representative Vang wanted to speak to that first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is another work group that convenes the boards and various mental health providers and other stakeholders to look at, there are barriers. One of the most main barriers to really having providers advance in their career or really being able to serve fully in the mental health workforce is the licensing process. And there is, so this group comes together to look at that specific barriers and to look at if there is an alternative pathways to licensing and evaluates whether that is a possible solution, and also continues to look at other barriers to licensure as well. So this is something that I've worked with the boards to reach an agreement, and that is something that this is the latest language that we've come up with in agreeing to.
Okay, thank you. And that would be on R52.
Yes.
Which I'm trying to get to here.
if I can just hear from the board that this is something they can do.
Mr. Sands?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Benson. Sam Sands from the Board of Psychology. What I will say is that we did work with Representative Bang on the language included in this section, although I would say from at least the Board of Psychology's perspective, it falls short of agreement. My thoughts about this particular section was, and especially based on the testimony in several House committees, was that this was really focused on trying to eliminate the national exam for psychologists or somehow lowering the standard for certain groups for the exam for psychologists, which would make us the only state in either the United States or Canada that would require an applicant not to pass this licensing exam. Again, I think that there's opportunity to continue to work on this language to identify barriers. I just think that the focus on testing would not serve Minnesota well and continue to grow mental health providers in the state and encourage people to continue to get reimbursed and things like that.
So I just have to say thank you, Mr. Sands. I don't know that I was there for every hearing in the House, but I never heard that. I never heard that there was an attempt to eliminate the national test requirement or any kind of attempt to reduce standards. Now, I could certainly understand that concern you might have, but I frankly never heard that in any hearing. I don't know if Representative Vang did. I'm going to go to her first and to respond to that, and then I'll go to Senator Curran, who has his hand up. Representative Vang.
Madam Chair, I've not heard that before, and you know that is not the intent of this language. It's not to eliminate the national licensing exam. What we do know, and this is from the work that community stakeholders and providers have who have done the work and who are will know firsthand knowledge of the barriers to licensure, that they're saying that the licensing exam cannot be the only tool to measure competency to do the work of providing a mental health care. What this language does is it looks at a possible solution, and it continues to look at potential barriers and also looks at potential solutions. So it doesn't create an alternative pathways or it doesn't eliminate the national licensing exam. This is something, it's more of an exploratory matter, just like any work groups or task force that we do to explore solutions, explore issues. It continues to do. So this is something that I've not heard from. I've worked with the boards since the beginning of the session. This is the first time, and that's not the intent of this language as well.
All right, I'm gonna go to Senator Curran, and then I think Mr. McQuarrie from Wilder might have something he wanted to share. Senator Curran, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so I appreciate the conversation. My question was gonna be that, then if the alternative, the legislation appears to propose an alternative licensing vehicle, what would we eliminate and what would we modify? And if so, and then the further clarification, it sounds like that we don't know what those barriers are. In many cases, I'm puzzled. We speak of that we have many known barriers, and then in the same conversation, when the barriers have been highlighted in licensing, as Mr. Sands spoke about, that we would reduce it or change it. And then in the second half of the conversation, we talk about, well, we have to study to see what those known barriers are. Either we have known barriers or we don't. And if we have barriers and we want to seek alternative licensing, who would be then eligible for that alternative licensing? and who wouldn't be eligible for that alternative licensing path. And you'll get an ally if you want to get rid of licensing in many cases. I just don't see that in most of the political agenda that's been pushed forward, where we reduce the standards. And I'm troubled that we would reduce the standards in any way. And an alternative path really wouldn't exist if you weren't reducing the standards somehow. So help me understand in this conversation about what are we really talking about? What are the barriers? What are the known hard barriers? Because we speak of them, that they're many. What are they? What are the known barriers today in the impetus for this legislation? And then what would we do to change it? And who would be eligible for it?
Madam Chair.
Oh, Representative Fang.
First, I just want to state again that the intent of this language does not eliminate or reduce the standards. It looks to explore the barriers and also explore potential solutions such as an alternative pathways. An alternative pathways to licensure is something that has precedent in the boards as well. The Board of Social Work has done this before in looking at developing alternative pathways to get licensed in social work. So it's not something new. It has precedent in the boards doing this work before. And I will just also add that this gives the boards and stakeholders opportunities to seek out data to see if there are disproportionate passing of the national exams. We know that there are students and providers who are not passing the licensing exam, and we want to know why. And that is something that what this working group can do. So it doesn't reduce standards. It doesn't eliminate the process that is working currently. So this just looks to look at what are other tools we can build out that can also continue to increase the providers within the workforce.
Thank you, Representative Bangham. Let me just, Senator Curran, yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate Representative Vang talking about. You did highlight one of the known barriers that you've stated that the students and providers are not passing the rigorous testing today. We have rigorous testing to make sure that we have the highest quality qualified people. You'll get 100% support if we go after the root cause of why are people not passing the test. And I think it starts with everything we talk about is it's always symptomatic of a root cause. And it goes back to their basic education, public education system. We got families that struggle, but we seem to talk about everything except the root cause or the corrective measures to make sure we have the highest level of education provided for everyone, not just through the K-12, but then on to higher education, which would then put everybody in the position. So if they take the career path and they're in position and have the education to pass these tests. But in no way, should we be limiting or lowering the standards in the test? But you'll gain 100% support at some of those root causes. But it starts at the fundamentals, back in K-12, and then on to the higher education. So thank you, Madam Chair.
So I just want to clarify something. It's my understanding that if somebody decided, say this work group went into effect and came back and said, we need a new kind of license in mental health, that is not something that could happen without legislation, is my understanding. And I don't know who I could go to confirm that, but I believe, you know, health licensing is not something that can be done without legislation. So, you know, I'll just let that stand unless someone here can correct me on that. But, you know, we are not going to be changing licensing based on the work of a work group without legislation and full consideration in this legislature. So, okay, I know that Mr. McQuarrie had wanted, and I saw that Mr. Sands, let me see if Mr. McQuarrie wants to, has something to add here, and then I will go back to Mr. Sands. Mr. McQuarrie, please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Dominic McQuarrie, Director of Public Policy and Community Relations at the Wilder Foundation. I think Representative Vang very well covered the impetus of the legislation. And I'll say significant changes had been made since the original draft at the behest of the licensing boards on the exact topic I think that's being covered here around presumption of the need or for an alternative pathway, to really clarify that this work group is about investigating what are the barriers to licensure that people are facing, and to consider alternative pathways as one of the solutions. I will add as well that in a lot of these conversations, especially around the disparities that exist for certain cultural communities in achieving full licensure or in achieving certain plateaus, we are told repeatedly that, you know, you have anecdotal evidence, the data doesn't exist. And that's something that we've run into as a part of this conversation as well. We have data from the Department of Health that has shown that there's a gap between graduates and those who are reaching full licensure, but we don't have data about what the failure rates are of these tests, how close people are, and ways that we could potentially get people over that hump without needing alternative pathway as well. So as you were saying, and as Representative Vang had added as well, I think this work group would be hugely beneficial in bringing a broad stakeholder community, including the licensing boards, together to investigate what these barriers are and ways that we could increase our workforce, knowing that we are at a growing need and demand for behavioral health services. So thank you for the time.
All right. Thank you, Mr. McQuarrie. And Mr. Sands, did you want to have something to add here as well? Okay, maybe he decided not to.
I do not, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, I was on mute.
Okay, all right, thank you, Mr. Sands. All right, further questions or comments about this section?
Madam Chair, I'm just looking. There are a number of other mental health working groups, culturally and linguistically appropriate services. So let's keep moving through Representative Vang provisions, but they're we've got a lot of work groups.
Right. Well, here. Senator, we've reached the end, I believe, Representative Vang's provisions, right? Representative Vang, do you want to make any closing comments on this?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Benson and committee members for the opportunity to speak on this. This is an important issue. It's a great provision. We've done a lot of work. This work has been done since 2013. And we'll continue, and even throughout session, I've continued to engage extensively with all the relevant stakeholders. So this is this bill has been vetted through. It has all the working parts that we need to continue to improve our the workforce for our providers. And I would like to ask for the support on this and hope to see it become law. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Representative Vang, for being available today to walk through this with us. And thank you to all of the testifiers as well. I shouldn't call you testifiers. You're here to be a resource for us. And we appreciate that very much. All of the boards and Ms. Afterholden, Mr. McQuarrie, and whoever else I am probably forgetting here, but thank you very much for your time and for all your work on this. Okay, I think we would, that was a lot more time than I thought we were gonna take on that provision or those provisions, I should say, but they are complex and they do weave through a lot of the bill. And so I'm gonna turn now to Representative Ryer, who's here to talk about the dental provisions in the bill. And members, just to say, we're not going to be adopting this today, obviously. This is a fiscal piece. We still don't have targets. It's good that we're going to be able to hear about this and have some discussion. It was not really my intention to go through every piece and wordsmith it today. I just don't know that we will be using our time well if we do that. But, you know, certainly I'm not, you know, would never say no if members have particular questions or particular pieces they want to discuss. But the intention was just to kind of talk about it more generally. We're going to be kind of putting it to the side for the time being anyway. So Representative Ryer, welcome. And please go ahead and let us know what is going on in this section of the bill. And just to orient everyone, this is in Article 1 of the bill. It's quite a number of sections. And also Senate Article 1, there's a section that probably pertains to this as well. And that would be Section 51. But this is a House-only provision. So Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Before we get started with discussion, I thought it would be helpful to give you an overview since, as Chair Liebling mentioned, there are a number of proposals throughout Article 1. Let me tell you, orient you a little bit on what the vision from the House for the dental program is. As many of us know, issues with Minnesota's public program dental services are longstanding, and efforts to find solutions have been ongoing. Yet the basic problem remains that far too many in our medical assistance and Minnesota care programs, especially children, do not get the dental care they need. Only about 37% of kids saw a dentist in 2016 and 2017. That's nearly two-thirds who went without basic care, even one appointment a year. This problem disproportionately affects the BIPOC community and is an equity issue. And this was an area of focus for the Blue Ribbon Commission, which created recommendations that were brought forward as the governor's proposal. What you'll hear about today, the House dental proposal for public programs, is not the governor's proposal. We have the same goal, achieving better dental care for all Minnesotans on public programs. Our bill differs in how we achieve it, bringing realistic strategies that simplify the system, improve reimbursement, and open doors to service delivery innovation. First, simplification. Our public programs dental system is extremely complex with many players, levels of administration, and reimbursement variations. It's confusing to dentists who often don't even know what they'll be paid for their services. We address this in part by engaging a third-party administrator to administer the dental services directly, rather than working through the managed care companies. This also provides much needed transparency to the dentists as well as to the legislature. Now on to reimbursement. Rates are one of the program's biggest problems. We're one of the lowest paying states in the nation, so many dentists can't afford to provide these services. Our House proposal addresses this by rebasing rates from 1989 submitted charges to a percentile of 2018 rates. This proposal alone brings rates into the current decade and will help all providers who choose to serve public programs enrollees. We also simplify the reimbursement system by removing most payment add-ons, and we use those funds to help pay for this rebasing. This change helps close the reimbursement gaps between what private dentists and the current critical access dental or CAD providers are paid. We then retain a 20% add-on for CAD providers, which will be used to fund a new incentive program that a coalition of CAD providers have been working on for over a year. The new program will be a dental home model that will pay our dental providers based on the value they're providing for MA enrollees. All parties engaged in this discussion understand that there will be metrics that will need to be met to earn this increased payment. This innovation also recognizes the complexity of care needs for many who are covered by MA across the state. In contrast, the governor's proposal would have completely eliminated the CAD program and put those funds into the overall base rate, which was very concerning to the CAD community, who currently provide a majority of care to MA enrollees. This compromise reimbursement model is supported by the Minnesota Dental Association and many critical access dental providers. In closing, we believe the House dental proposal will allow for transparency in the system and increase rates for our providers, moving Minnesota from the bottom of reimbursement rates nationwide. This, in turn, will help ensure that enrollees covered by our public programs can get the care they need. Now I'll look forward to any questions and discussion of this legislation. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Representative Ryer. And thank you for all your work on this. This has been, as you say, This has been a bipartisan and I think bicameral concern for quite a long time, because members of our legislature who work on health and human services understand that the mouth is part of the body and that people can't really be healthy unless they have reasonably good teeth, and that gum disease is, you know, there's more and more evidence about the overall impact. So by not providing what really is lower cost care and preventative care and not making sure that people get that, we probably are increasing our costs in higher level care. And so anyway, this is just something, I think I'm stating the obvious, I'm stating what members here all know and understand. And the conundrum has been, this is very expensive. You know, what? How do we do this? How do we make this work for everybody? And I have to say that Representative Ryer has taken this on and really dug in and worked with stakeholders. And this is one of those areas where everybody is never going to be happy, because, you know, it's just going to be impossible to have nobody complaining. But I think Representative Ryer has gotten this to certainly the best place I've seen it in my years in the legislature, that I've been somewhat focused on this area. And I think we, if of course, depending on our budget, we might have a golden opportunity here to make some real change in this. That, and I do know that dentists, the Dental Association, and a lot of groups are, and a lot of individuals are really solidly behind us making some of these changes. So anyway, I would open that up now to members. If you do want to look at specific language, that would be fine. I'm kind of hoping that we won't have to be here until noon, because I know that we all have other work that we need to get to. And this, of course, is not going to be resolved right now. But Senator Utke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, I would like to go into a little bit of the specific language. Tell us where the sections are, where we're starting, what we're looking at. And actually, just as a side note, as we jump around like we were last time, which was good to follow through, but if somebody could call out the page numbers, I think it gets everybody to the right page. But a couple things in particular that I'm wanting to see in this language is where we, I think we're going to see what's called carve-outs come into play. We talked about a third-party administrator, which I believe is just giving it to the department. Okay. And, of course, we're all interested in the rates to our dentists, because we know that the MA rates to our local dentists are, they're the lowest paid around. So with that, I will have more questions as we get into it, but if we could, if we could tell us where the this language starts, and we can start moving through it.
Okay, well, thank you, Senator. So this is mostly in Article 1, so I could just list the sections for you. They're not necessarily contiguous, some of them are. So it's 13, 23, 48, 49, 57, 58, and 63. And then there's a Senate Article 1, Section 51 that also relates to this. And let me just make a comment here. You know, this is a carve out, I guess is what you could call it, but let's just put that in context. This is the medical assistance program. This is public dollars. This is a public program. If you, if anybody is concerned about government taking this over, this is government. This is a government program for people who are on a public program. This is taxpayer dollars. So once again, we've talked about this in other contexts. You know, we have a responsibility to our taxpayers to make sure that we provide the service that we say we're providing, and that we understand how the dollars are flowing, because they are public dollars. So when you say in a way, oh, this is DHS doing it in a sort of pejorative way, you know, this is DHS is our public agency that we have created and maintained through statute to do our, in large, a large part of what they do is run our public programs. So in this particular proposal, they would be hiring a third party administrator, not to bear risk, but simply to run the program. So that is a way that this is done in quite a few different states. There are different models. This is not an unusual thing. This would not be adding to DHS personnel, I don't think, in the fiscal note. Representative Ryer could correct me, but this is hiring a third-party administrator. And it is, so it would be running it in a central way, running our public program through one administrator instead of multiple administrators, where we don't know how the money is flowing or even how much dentists are being paid for the same service in different places. So, you know, this is running it through the MCOs is an experiment. It's a so-called demonstration project that was started many years ago now, and it's still demonstrating. And to me, frankly, what it's demonstrated is that it isn't doing the job very well, certainly in this area of dental coverage for our Minnesota patients. So, Senator Utke.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And as the lingo you just, what you just went into, I don't care who does it. I care about efficiencies, and what we have seen from a lot of the department operations, that has not been the case. So I don't care so much where it goes, and that's why I want to look at the language, because we care about efficiencies. And I would disagree that what we've had has been a problem, but let's take a look at the whole thing and how can we get better and hold them all accountable.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Senator. And I agree. This is about efficiency. It's about good use of our taxpayer dollars to get what we think we should be getting with those dollars. And I've often said, we will never have enough money to waste it. Never. We are always looking to be able to provide what we need in health and human services in particular. So, Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not going to do deep dive into the language, but it doesn't look like DHS is required to competitively bid this. Is there language about a competitive bid in here? Or could DHS just pick somebody?
So let's see. I'm not sure if who could really address that. But Senator, isn't it the case that generally speaking, under our statutes, unless it's emergency orders, obviously, that's a different animal. Aren't they required to anyway? I don't know if it would have to be in this section, but maybe, I don't know if staff can help us with that. Is there either Senate counsel or House research, if anybody can help with that? Because it certainly is not our intention that there be a reduction in competitive bidding here.
Madam Chair, RFP process, but I just want to make sure that any provision would require competition, measured outcomes. These vendors can get contracts, and if there's not a plan, we end up in the exact same place we were.
Okay, and I think that, Representative Ryer, are you able to address this?
Yeah, I can give you my Madam Chair, Senator Benson. I can give you my perspective on it, which is the same as yours, Senator Benson. Having spent many years within a health plan, I understand how the processes work. I understand to Senator Utke's concern as well, where inefficiency and efficiency reside and how they can be increased and improved. So we have structural inefficiency in the program as it is with multiple managed care plans, some of whom work with a third-party administrator to run their dental program. So we've got layers upon layers already. So to me, we're achieving a great deal more elegance in solution by going to a third-party administrator. In terms of selecting one, though, not all third-party administrators are created equal. And so making sure that they are qualified, are effective in getting funds paid quickly and correctly, that's been one of the concerns that's come from stakeholders. It's like, okay, we're open to change, but we want to make sure it's good change. And so making sure that we are properly vetting and doing a competitive process, I think, is fundamental to any situation where we would engage an organization like this, similar to what we do with engaging managed care plans now.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Benson.
Follow up, if Mr. Berg could tell me what line item this is on the spreadsheet, and it has, and I'm sorry, I looked for the fiscal note. I might have gotten it in the wrong place. If council can send the fiscal note, it'll give me a better understanding of what DHS's perceived processes will be, because fiscal notes are sometimes more telling than language. If they include in the fiscal note an RFP process, then I'll know that there's an RFP process. So if Mr. Berg could let me know what line item on the spreadsheet, and if council could send us the fiscal note for this provision.
Mr. Berg?
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, the House provisions begin on line 846 of the joint spreadsheet. And I should note that there isn't a fiscal note on this. These were put together within the governor's appropriations, and the department was working with members, including Representative Ryer, to fashion language that fit within that set of numbers. So there is no separate fiscal note on this.
Okay. Senator? And then I'll go to Senator Hoffman.
I know there's been a tradition in the House that you don't need fiscal notes to put things on a spreadsheet. So I guess
I'm not aware of that tradition, Senator. You know, if it comes from the governor's budget and it's been costed out, then indeed we don't feel we have to go and, you know, so in this case, we said, here's the appropriation. Representative Ryer told the Department of Human Services, here's how much money we're going to keep, what you've already costed out here. And we want you to rework this to do what we want it to do. So she's nodding. So that's, but I just had to, sorry, I'm not aware that there's any such tradition. I think, you know, this is what we costed it out at. I'm sure we can get further. If we need to refine the proposal, I'm sure we'll get further fiscal refinement from the from the department.
Because this doesn't line up with the governor's provisions. And without a fiscal note, I'm not exactly sure that I can tell what's causing the increase in cost in the tails. Some of that, I mean, I know you talked about eliminating the critical access provision and then doing a 20% add-on. Seeing that map would be helpful to understanding. So that if we need to make choices about what we do, the fiscal note would help me understand if we give this dollar amount input, this is the impact it will have. You know, the department says they only need one FTE. What's their process going to be for acquiring a vendor? All of those things the department would be able to tell us. This is a big change. And so for the department to tell us they need zero in the first year and then one ongoing doesn't match my experience with even small things. The department will charge a full FTE for a work group. So I'm going to need to see a fiscal note on this okay. So that I can understand what provisions are adding what cost.
Well, fair enough, Senator. I mean, we can certainly lean on the department to give us more precise costing out of what we've got here. And I know Representative Ryer is listening. She has a great, she's done a lot of work here, and she has a great deal of interest, as all of us do, in getting something done. And I'm very hopeful that this will be the year that we can get something done. And we certainly are, we all want to do it right. Absolutely, we do.
And Madam Chair, Senator, to that point, the Senate put in administrative simplification, uniform prior authorization, a fee disclosure, and the dental home pilot. So we acknowledge there's work to be done in this space. We certainly didn't go as far as the House did, but we acknowledge there's work to be done. And in existing appropriations might become the challenge. So.
Right. And Senator, I'm kind of aware of that. And so that's kind of why I'm really hopeful about this, because I know there's a lot of shared interest and shared understanding that we have a big problem. And we need to solve it. And I know that, as I said before, and as Representative Breyer was saying, we all know that there needs to be some change.
Right.
And anyway, so let me go to Senator Hoffman, who's been waiting a while. Senator?
Thank you, Chair Liebling and Chair Benson. This is a good discussion. I got to figure out how to lower my hand. There you go. Years ago, this prompted a little piece that years ago we issued some cost shifting that ended up affecting folks that were on controlled substances because of mental health or whatever, right? The things that they're taking medicine and it's destroying their teeth, yet we knocked out preventative care because of a cost issue. This was years ago. And I'm wondering if this rebasing, that concern is still there. The issue is there about the reimbursement rates. People with disabilities are getting put on the side. There's no equity in that. And so my question to you is, does the rebasing of the rates fix that issue that was created years ago? And I see Dr. Helgeson is on here too. I don't know if he can answer that question. Does this do it, or Liz Ryer? And again, I'm not asking people to do it, but it just that existed chairs and if this addresses that, I'd like to know how.
Well, let me go to Representative Ryer. Representative Ryer, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, just a couple of points. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Hoffman. On the one hand, if the enrollee is in public programs, it will help. If they are not in a public program, this, of course, is a public program bill, and so it won't have an effect. But yes, the idea is that in investing in the base, we're doing some of the all boats rise, along with the special recognition that there are complexities that require unique approaches, both because of who the members are, and I would include enrollees who are people with disabilities in that, absolutely. We just know that there is more to creating the care experience that everyone needs. So that's where the add-on piece comes in and the dental health. So there is the improving overall. My hope is that that's going to help attract more dentists. The arithmetic problem is there are X number of people who need care, and there are Y number of people who are working like crazy to get that care to them, and they're growing and they're doing great work. How do we continue to enable new approaches that get people where they are to flourish and in a way that dentists can afford to do the work? We need the critical access dental system to be strong and resilient. And we need to grow the system overall so that more people are getting the care they need in the way they need it. I don't know if that touches on your question sufficiently, Senator Hoffman, and I'll turn it back to Chair Liebling to perhaps bring in Dr. Helgeson.
Yes, thank you so much, Representative Breyer. Dr. Helgeson, did you want to respond to some of this? Welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Dr. Michael Helgeson. I'm the CEO at AppleTree, and my background is in geriatric and special care dentistry. So taking care of people with disabilities and a wide variety of special needs is my focus. And I would just say that and I see Jogo is here from DHS. They've provided really granular detail on what the rebasing would mean. And it brings the rates into the current century, not only the current decade. And it will have a really terrific effect for people with disabilities, because a lot of the services that they need, the costs back in 1989 are completely out of sync with what the current costs are. So the details of it would be extremely beneficial for providers like AppleTree, for Hennepin Healthcare, and other Gillette's, other special needs. We've had a chance to look at it, and it would be a fantastic benefit that would enable us to provide the right care at the right time.
Thank you, Dr. Helgeson. Senator Hoffman, anything further?
No, Madam Chair. I just know that, you know, as we talk about creating, you know, opportunities or enhancing or you know, I've always wondered, what did we ever do to correct right the wrong? And thank you. I saw Helgeson on, because I know AppleTree looks at our elderly, looks at people that are, you know, complex needs, and know that there's always been a barrier there. And after all, that's what we should be doing, is looking out for the most vulnerable in the state of Minnesota. And so that just sets that. So hearing that conversation of the rebasing, you know, does it. Now, that's where you and Senator Benson are going to have the conversation, is there a cost to this, and how that's gonna be. So I appreciate hearing that information, and thank you, Madam Chair, for letting me ask that question.
Yeah, thank you, Senator. And you know, one of the things, I know you are very focused around people with disabilities, and I, in this space, one of the things that's always bothered me a great deal is that we're talking also about a lot of our children. And children, you know, if they're going to school with teeth that hurt, that it's really hard to learn when you have a toothache. And, you know, I've learned so much from Dr. Helgeson and others about how important baby teeth are, and having healthy baby teeth, and the lifelong impacts of having your baby teeth rot. And I mean, this just has so many ramifications. It's prevention is pretty cheap, honestly, compared to what happens when we don't do it. So anyway, Senator Benson, I could go on for a long time on this. Obviously, this is an issue I feel very passionate about.
Yes, if I could, Madam Chair, if Mr. Reese could send the rebasing information, sort of, you know, what the step looks like, because to be candid, all rebasing is scalable. And so I would like to see what that looks like as we step up to the numbers that are in the bill. But I also need clarification, and maybe Mr. Reese is the right person. Was there a withhold associated with PMAP on dental? And do we have to pay that back if there was? Because I thought there was a quality withhold related to dental.
Great, and I'm gonna call on Mr. Hayes, and then also I was gonna even give him an opportunity to comment on any of the other pieces that he's been listening to in the conversation. So please introduce yourself, Mr. Hayes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Giogo Hayes with the Department of Human Services. To answer a couple of the questions that came up, first, Senator Benson, your question, we can certainly send you the breakdown of the numbers. If you all are interested, I can explain those as well, but I'll defer to you on that. There was a performance-based withhold for dental that's been extended an extra year due to COVID. So it was 3 years, and now it's extended to 4 years. So that hasn't been finalized yet. That will be over before this proposal would take effect, would be effective January 1, 2023. I think those impacts end up kind of washing out before we get to the effective date of this proposal. To answer your other question real briefly, Senator Benson, my understanding is the state is required to follow all procurement laws related to contracting. And so we are required to issue an RFP, and that is certainly our intent to issue an RFP for this particular contract. That was the question you asked at the beginning.
Thank you. Senator Benson, anything more on that?
No, I appreciate that very much. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And yeah, and Mr. Hayes, I mean, I think you got the sense here that, you know, as we go forward with this, we probably will need some, you know, even though we don't have a formal fiscal note on this, you know, perhaps you and your team could work up a more formal kind of costing out, how the provision costs out and how the calculations are being done. That would be helpful. Okay, other questions or comments on this proposal? And I will leave it to members to to read through the specifics of it. And as I said at the outset, this is not something that is going to be resolved immediately because it's a budgetary item and a somewhat large one at that. So, I know Senator Benson and I and other members of the conference committee will have to wrestle with this, but first maybe we should, put some pins in the folks who are figuring out the budget targets to give us some money because we need it and our people in Minnesota need it. And this is an area where even though we don't have that dynamic scoring that we all would wish we had in Health and Human Services where we find out and get to account for the savings down the road when we improve people's health, I feel pretty sure that improving dental health for low-income Minnesotans would actually have some savings. And so I'd love to be able to think about that as we do this, Senator.
And Madam Chair, both of us have the periodontal provision. Maybe we just need to track emergency room visits for dental interventions and just take any savings that result from reduced dental services delivered in the emergency room. I don't know how else to prove out what we keep saying, which is pay up front, pay me now or pay me later seems to be the mantra in Health and Human Services. Dental, it just seems intuitively obvious that if you get somebody when their cavity is very small and you give them a filling instead of waiting until they have a full-blown need for a crown because of decay, it just seems like it would avoid some emergency room engagement. But not being able to prove that out has become, I know, a source of frustration for you as it has for me.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Senator. I think that's so right. The number 50 million sticks in my mind from some years ago that we were trying to get some estimates of how much we actually spend on emergency room care for people with under MA for dental emergencies. Mm-hmm. And even with what you just said, the people on our programs, I think maybe, and Dr. Helgeson can correct me if I'm wrong, but if somebody does, have that rotting tooth, I don't think they get the crown. I think they get the tooth pulled. And so that means that down the road, the rest of their teeth are impacted and maybe their nutrition is impacted and all kinds of things. And I think none of us would accept that as our dental care. And yet we accept it for our citizens, which, makes us very sad. Dr. Helgeson, anything on that?
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, thank you so much for bringing up this really important topic. And yes, there was a study that showed Minnesota spending about $50 million per year statewide in emergency rooms for managing dental abscesses and related things. And I want to highlight that's $50 million that is completely wasted. It's antibiotics, which are being misused at that point, and it's narcotics, which are creating all sorts of problems. It's not $50 million to actually take teeth out and do what was needed. It's completely inappropriate $50 million that people get their pain covered up with those two drugs. They still need exactly what caused the pain in the first place to be done. So it really is nuts to not provide the right reimbursement rates and get people the early care, Senator Benson, that you mentioned, get them in, get the preventive care, get the periodontal care. And it's not just that their dental gets more expensive, pulling a tooth and then having to replace it with a partial, that costs a lot of money. But it's also their diabetes. We spend hundreds of millions of dollars on diabetic care. And we know if you have chronic infections in the mouth, maintaining, your A1C is complicated. And we know there are lots of other things that are very costly on the medical side of the ledger. So I agree with what you're saying, Senator Benson and Representative Liebling, completely, that we just need to start spending the money smartly. And I don't think there's anyone among dental stakeholders who would disagree that increasing and rebasing the base rates is just essential. There's no path to success that doesn't include that particular step.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Helgeson, and thank you so much for all your years of advocacy in this area. And I know the fact that we all have so much feeling for this issue is probably a lot of that is due to your advocacy, I'm sure. So, all right. Members, I think that we've kind of reached the end of where we were going to go today, unless there's anything else. And we do have a lot of offline work to do. And Senator Benson, I don't know if you're prepared to give a roadmap for tomorrow. Maybe we should be speaking offline before you do that. Did you want to, anything you want to share?
Madam Chair, I think you and I need to connect this afternoon. You know, as of 9 o'clock this morning, we still didn't have targets, but negotiations continue. Frankly, at this point, I don't see how we close up a bill and get it off the floor before the end of session. So you and I should start making specific plans as to how we're going to spend the rest of our time. So I would rather do that before we make a public announcement. But we will notice the public as soon as we know.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Thank you. That's kind of what I thought you might, where you might be on this. So, all right. Anything else from members before we adjourn for today? Then we'll give you an hour of your lives back. And not seeing anything. Representative Ryer, thank you so very much for coming today and talking with us. And thank you to Dr. Helgeson and all of the advocates who worked on this and all of the staff who've worked on this, and really very much appreciated. And we'll see where we go. And with that, we are adjourned.